One of the fascinating topics of the Bible is the subject of prophecy. One third of the Bible is prophecy. You've heard that before in the past, and about 90% of prophecy has not been fulfilled yet. It is yet to be fulfilled at the leading up to the second coming of Christ, going into the millennium itself and beyond. So there's quite a bit in the Bible that is yet to happen that we certainly want to be made aware of. The number one nation spoken of in prophecy is Israel. Israel. Most students of Bible prophecy believe that the modern Jewish state of Israel represents all of Israel in Bible prophecy. It is a very major mistake. It's a very popular teaching in the evangelical area. One popular book out right now, The Four Blood Moons, some of you have it and ask me questions about it, by John Hagee out of San Antonio, Texas. He has an organization called the Christian, Christian Unity for Israel, something about that. What is it? United, okay, that's what it is. Christians United for Israel. Now, what Israel do you think he's talking about? Well, the Israeli state, the Jewish state in the Middle East. Many others, likewise, believe that everything in the Bible about Israel in the time of the end and prophecy, of course, has to do with the Jewish state and the Jewish people. In his book, he talks about that I just referred to, Genesis 12, which we're going to go to in just a moment or so away. And in that, where he says, those who bless you, I will bless those who bless you. One of the promises God gave to Abraham. And he says that's for the Jews. And so he goes around and he wants to get people to give money to be sent to the Jewish state. And if you do that, God will bless you. Well, is that what God meant by that and that promise that he gave to Abraham in that sense? Another one that I thought was very interesting, that after 9/11, back in 01, Hal Lindsey, who is a very noted writer, he first became noted when he wrote his book, The Late Great Planet Earth, back in the mid-70s. He came out with a book, The Everlasting Hatred, The Roots of Jihad. Basically what it is showing, that of course that the people there, and he quotes correctly some of the scriptures of the eternal hatred that has been there. I've used them in the past too, in the book of Amos and so on. But applies it, of course, to the Jewish state and the Jewish people and to them only. And it goes back and gives a very good, interesting history of how effort was made to open up the Palestine and the Middle East for a Jewish state, going back as far as the Puritans trying to petition the British government in 1650. Oliver Cromwell was prime minister, 1655 and so forth. And to allow, it's interesting, it was through Britain. And down through the years, 350 years it took before there was a Jewish state. Now, what I wanted to read to you as I'm in this introduction, as I'm leading into it, is what I thought was fascinating by admission by Hal Lindsey. Where does America fit in prophecy about the last days? This has been a disturbing question for Hal Lindsey for more than 40 years. Here is the United States, the undisputed leader of the West since World War II, the only true superpower in the world today. And yet it is not mentioned in the last days' prophecies. Not mentioned. No, nowhere. Of course, that's always been a question we would raise to people on this subject. But another power is clearly predicted to lead the West and then the world in the climactic events that precede the second coming of Jesus Christ. According to the prophets, A revived form of the old Roman people and culture in the form of 10 strong nations will rise to take over the West. Wouldn't disagree with that at all. Prophets like the Apostle John and Daniel foresaw a precise scenario regarding the alignment of powers in the last days. And the U.S. is not a world leader in these predictions. The inescapable conclusion is that something catastrophic will occur specifically to America. And yet, he cannot understand, because at the time of writing, It is the strongest and greatest nation on the earth, not mentioned anywhere in the Bible. Well, I think most of us realize that is not correct. But I wanted to point out what Hal Lindsey thinks and then also what John Hagee thinks, and there are many others. They all seem to agree about one thing, and that is that they believe that the Jewish state and the Jewish people are Israel and no one else is. Well, you're going to miss out on a lot of things in prophecy if that should be the case. In fact, some of the end-time prophecies show clearly that there is the house of Israel and the house of Judah that do both exist prior to the second coming of Christ, but they will both go into captivity. And I've done this before, but I don't want to take the time to go back through the scriptures. There are Isaiah 11, Ezekiel 37, and Zechariah chapter 10, all three places. And those three chapters show clearly there is a house of Israel and there is a house of Judah in the time of the end, and they both will go into captivity. They will both be brought out of captivity a second time by Jesus Christ when he returns. So let's take a look at this subject. It's very important. We're seeing a lot of things happening right now. The Mideast peace talks are breaking down. They have broken down. They're not going to go anywhere. I cannot imagine that there could ever be any kind of a, quote, Mideast peace between Palestinians and the rest of the Arab world and the Jewish state because of the fact that they want to drive them clear out of the Middle East. They want that. They want Jerusalem. And there's no way there would ever be a settlement over the Temple Mount. And they want the Temple Mount, and they want anything, any vestige of the past of Solomon's Temple. They want to say it never existed, and they want to do all that they can to make sure that the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque are preserved on the Temple Mount. So you can see there's no way that there's going to be a compromise over those issues. I'd like to go and begin by going to Romans chapter 9, Romans chapter 9 and verse 3. For I could wish, Paul says, that I myself were accursed from Christ for my brethren, my countrymen, according to the flesh, who are Israelites, to whom pertains the adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the service of God, and the promises. And the promise. What was he referring to? He is saying, and yes, he's referring specifically to the Jewish people and those of Benjamin, as he was a Benjaminite, and to the rest of Israel, as we'll see as we go along, because the promises pertain to them. And we need to look at those promises. I think it's a fascinating study, very interesting. I never get tired of this, going through it. We start now in Genesis chapter 12. That's where the promises are first given. And we're going to see both national, as I think most of you already know, national promises, and, of course, spiritual promises that Jesus Christ would come through the descendants of Abraham. In Genesis 12, and in verses 1 through 3, now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Well, here in verse 3, we see the two promises that are given, one of national blessings, and make a great nation that will come from Abraham. And the other one is eternal salvation, and of course, through Abraham in his lineage and descendancy, of course, as we will see, that Jesus Christ would come. What I'm going to focus on, though, are the promises of national blessings today, the promises of national blessings. The reason why is because when you begin to follow the line down to the end, you begin to understand a little bit more about Bible prophecy. You begin to see that, unlike what Hal Lindsey was frustrated over, yes, not just only this nation, but other nations, the British nation, and it's others that of its commonwealth, the Canadians, the Australians, yes, they're all a part of that people. And I might just say this, it has always kind of, they would scoff at that, but it stymies me as to why. I mean, if you were a detective and you wanted to find out what happened to the tribes that went into captivity by the Assyrians. I mean, the clues are there. In fact, here 2 years ago in Biblical Archaeology Review magazine, which I take, they had an article on the writings and inscriptions of the tribes of Israel in the Assyrian tablets that were taken out of Nineveh, and showing that indeed they had been there. Then you follow the steps to the Behistun stone that Darius the not the great, which one was he? It was not the first Darius. It wasn't Darius the Mede, but he had inscripted on the side of that rock in three languages all that he had conquered. And I believe it was the 19th province that he had conquered, which, when translated, came down to the house of Omri. Omri was the second, he king after Jeroboam, after the split. They didn't call him by the name Israel, the other nations, that is. They called him by the dynasty that ruled. And the house of Omri ruled after Jeroboam to the end, the time of the end of the northern country, nation of Israel. It was his descendants that continued on the throne up to the end. And then, well, I mean, they're just, well, let me get back here. And even Jesus Christ, and I'm going to show you that here being, at the end, gave a commission to the apostles where to go. And when you look at that, you're just amazing to me, especially here you get religious people, evangelicals, don't you know where they went? He said, you won't cover all the house, all the cities of Israel. Well, they covered all the cities of Judah, starting with Jerusalem. They didn't miss a one. But he said, you're going to go to all Israel, to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Well, it's important to find out, well, where did the apostles go? Well, we'll come to that here a little bit later. Let's kind of follow this along. I think it's very interesting. It starts with, you're going to be a great nation. Is that the end? That's it? No. God gives a little here and a little there, doesn't he? Let's go now to chapter 13. Chapter 13, verse 14. And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, remember Lot went to the good land down by the Dead Sea, which wasn't dead apparently at that time, and lift your eye, verse 14, the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, lift your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, westward. For all the land which you see, I give to you and your descendants forever, and I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could number the dust of the earth, then your descendants also could be numbered. Arise, walk in the land through its length and its width, for I give it to you. And actually, he was giving more than just that land that he was in at that particular time, because when you look at those words there, they would be as the dust of the ground, the northward, in all four directions. There are no borders. There are no borders. And as we will see, indeed, they were to expand far beyond the area. How would they get beyond the area of Palestine? Well, it's interesting, the events that God would bring about to get the descendants of the house of Israel and those of the house of Judah beyond the land of what the Greeks called Palestine. Now let's turn the page to chapter 15 and verse 18. And in verse 18 it says, on the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given the land from the river of Egypt, which I believe indeed is the Nile, to the great river, the river Euphrates. Now I've given you that land, he says. Now we begin to see how much it is expanding. It's beyond the land of the Canaanites when we get to chapter 15. We keep expanding this thing. And that, by the way, that is going to be the land when Jesus Christ returns. That will include a lot of things like Damascus and Syria. Places, well, all you have to do is look on a globe or whatever. Where is the Euphrates River? Where is the Nile? And between the two. Now, some have tried to argue that it was a wadi in what today is the Gaza Strip. I do not believe that is the case. I've looked this up in commentaries, that it indeed, that river is referring to the Nile River. That is the major river. From one major river to the other major river would be the borders. Now, what's the north and south when Christ returns? I can't say that I know right at this time. We turn the page over, chapter 17. We keep going, more information. Time goes by. I'm going to give you a little bit more, a little here and a little there, Abraham. And it is forever. Now, these are important clues, by the way, because if you're looking at the time of the end, you need clues to find where they are because they've lost their identity. Here in chapter 17, in verse 5 through 8, "No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations." Many nations. How many nations were in the Bible in the Old Testament? I only know of two. Many, I think, is more than two, don't you? It is. So when is God going to make those many nations? He didn't make them in the Old Testament. There was only two in the Old Testament. Israel and Judah, after the division, after Solomon's death. Verse 6, "I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you." Well, multiple kings, not just a single dynasty, which, of course, there is through David, as we'll get to later. But here he's talking about many different kings, many different nations. Well, when did that ever happen in the Bible? It certainly never did. Verse 7, "And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you in their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your descendants after you. Also, I give you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." Well, we already just found out in the previous chapter, chapter 15, it also is going to include from river to river. But this land of Canaan, and when Christ returns, that land of Canaan, which I'm not sure what the borders would have been anciently of that land of Canaan, it will include the West Bank and much more than what you see of the state of Israel today. That will be given, and that will be the start. And it will go out from there and eventually from river to river and around the world. There is a purpose. The purpose is to bring the knowledge of God, which, of course, Israel failed. They were to be a nation of priests. That was part of the old covenant, which they failed miserably at that. All right, going forward to chapter 22 of Genesis. Genesis 22, verse 17 and 18. "Blessing, I will bless you, and multiplying, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven, as the sand which is on the seashore. And your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies." Now, this is the first time that's been brought up. Strategic, by the way, that's interesting when you take time to research that. It's talking about strategic areas, not just only, certainly sea lanes would be very much a part of that. Places where you, I'll tell you where there's one right there in Palestine. It's at Megiddo. That's a gate. Because there have been more wars fought in the valley of Jezreel. Because those who were advancing would come from the north through the valley of Jezreel because it's all nice and flat. And then they would go out the southwestern corner by Megiddo, which is why Solomon fortified Megiddo. You can go there and tour that place. Because up there on the height, and they have to come through here as a perfect place to stop them. The Battle of Armageddon will be there at that valley and, of course, in that strategic location. But we know, too, that it applies to, in the time of the end, having the sea gates, having the mountain passes, having the areas that they would consider the high ground and defensible. So I'm going to give you here, he says, "the gates of their enemies. And in your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice." There we see the second promise in verse 18, and that would be, of course, through Jesus Christ. I keep going along here. Chapter 24, verse 60. Here's where Eleazar goes to the house of Nahor to, Nahor, I believe, is deceased at this time, but his son Laban has a sister named Rachel, and she will be willing to go back sight unseen to become the wife of Isaac. Now, there's a lot that is not told here in this chapter. You can tell by reading verse 60 what Rebekah's response was when they asked her if she wanted to go back. And they blessed Rebekah and said to her, after she has said yes, "Our sister, may you become the mother of thousands of 10,000s, and may your descendants possess the gates of those who hate them." Well, Eleazar must have spent the night up very late talking there to Laban and others. They wouldn't have known that. And that had to have been passed on. And of course, where did he get it from? Well, he got it from his master, who was Abraham, who he worked for. But again, we see that they believed, and why was part of that? It was the fact that, well, yes, we believe what you're telling us, and we trust you, and we're sending our sister back to be married to Isaac and to be inherited of these promises that have been given through, in this case, my uncle Abraham. And they had enough contact. They knew Abraham, that they trusted him. And very interesting. Well, in Genesis 26, verses 1 through 5, again, the promises are, well, in this one, it not only says that Abraham obeyed God, but it reconfirms to Isaac, his son, that he's going to have, it's going to be passed on to him. In verse 1, there was a famine in the land besides the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Abimelech, who was king of the Philistines in Gerar. Then the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land of which I shall tell you." It wasn't time to go to Egypt, was it? "Dwell in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father." It's going to be passed on to you and to your descendants. "Because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." One verse I didn't read in chapter 15, verse 8, Abraham believed God and it was accounted to him as righteousness, quoted by Paul in the book of Romans. All right, skipping up, let's go to Genesis 35. I'll move here through the book of Genesis and on to some other things. It's good that you have a trail of this, that you can see these promises. You know, he talks about, to me, when I look at chapter 17, which I just read to you a few minutes ago, and you think about nations, kings, what is he saying to Abraham at that time? And when you look back in history, when did that ever come to pass? Well, here in Genesis 35 and before I get there, I want Genesis 28, because there's a key thing in Genesis 28 about this that was given to Jacob. In Genesis 28, verses 12 through 15, "Then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached to heaven, and there the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, 'I am the Lord God of Abraham your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and your descendants. Also, your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and the east, the north and the south.'" There is no limit. That's what he is saying, that you're going to spread. "In you and in your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." The second great promise, of course, would come through Jesus Christ. But those directions that were given, there are no limits that were put on how far you would expand and go. And in fact, the promises as we go forward here, that's exactly what's going to take place. They're going to leave that land eventually, one way or the other. And for a period of time, they're going to be no longer there. Now let's go to Genesis 35, because here we see something that is brand new. How's God going to fulfill this? Genesis 35 and in verse 10 through 11. "And God said to him, 'Your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name.' So he called his name Israel. Also God said to him, 'I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. And the land which I have I gave Abraham and Isaac, I give to you and to your descendants after you, I give this land, as he says. Well, that's quite a promise. This is the first time we see about how this is going to be fulfilled. From you is going to be a nation and a company of nations. There was a person one time wanted to argue with me. Well, maybe because he didn't want to believe this. The company of nations probably were the other tribes, all the tribes put together. No, they were just what that word said. They were tribes of one of two nations. After the death of Solomon, either of the northern kingdom or of the southern kingdom. There were three tribes in the southern kingdom, Judah, Levi, and Benjamin. Northern kingdom were all the other ones left. And as we will see, many times in the prophets referring to the northern kingdom, they go by the one who becomes the firstborn, takes the place of Reuben, and that is Ephraim. And a lot of times when it's talking about Ephraim, it's talking about the northern kingdom of Israel or the house of Israel. Because Ephraim was now the one who was be the head of it. All right, let's go to Genesis 48. Genesis 48. Again, here is the promise that is given to Jacob, of course, bestowing upon the sons of Joseph. You know, God is the one who selects, and he sees in individuals things that we may not see. Of course, we usually don't. Joseph was a righteous man. And yet it says of Judah, he prevailed among his brethren. Now, when you look at the life of Judah as the individual, one of the sons of Jacob, he was not exactly a righteous man. And he was behind selling Joseph into Egypt. He was involved with his former daughter-in-law, Tamar, in Genesis 38, and having twin children by her. So you stop and you ask, well, how is it that he prevailed? Well, God obviously was looking at certain things about the descendants of Judah, not the individual of Judah, the man. Because when you get to the time of the Israelites and Moses, the predominant tribe is Judah. And when you go to the census in Numbers chapter 1, Judah has the most men that can field an army for protection of Israel. Not only that, but they seem to be the strongest. When Joshua goes into the promised land, it is the tribe of Judah that is sent forward to clear the way. And they do clear the way of the southern part of Palestine through the hill country of moving out the Philistines and others who were there. There was something there. And you'll see it in the prophecy here in chapter 49 about Judah, but kind of getting ahead. God is the one who makes the choices, and we don't always know exactly what the reason is, especially if you compare Judah to Joseph as individuals. Here in chapter 48 and verse 15 and 16, and he blessed Joseph, that is, Jacob did, and said, God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day. Now, I like that last part. We many times don't stop. We read right over that. What is he saying? The God who has taken care of me all my life long. We need to stop and look at that ourselves. You know, that same God has taken care of us all of our life. And he will to the end. Jesus said, I'm with you to the end of the age, which means what? I'm with you to the end of your life. I'm with you to the end of your life. And that was the one who was directly there aiding and helping Jacob. Verse 16, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named on them. Well, what was his name? We just heard. It's now Israel. So Israel is named on who? The sons of Joseph. Is Israel named specifically on the Jews? No, they would be the house of Judah later. And where Ephraim goes, they would be the house of Israel. And the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. And then dropping down here in verse 19, but his father refused, here on crossing the hands, and I know, my son, I know, in other words, Manasseh was actually the older one. He also shall become a people, that is Manasseh, and he also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. How was it that Ephraim became greater than Manasseh? By becoming a multitude of nations. There was a time when the sun never set on the British Empire in the 19th century. Yes, in the 20th century and now into the 21st, although we have become very, very weak in many ways, yet we still are a very, very strong nation as an individual nation. But how does God count the greatness here? He counted the greatness in the fact that, well, you're one nation, and you will be a great nation, but you will be many. And that's why you will be greater, because you will be many nations. And so that, you know, you compare our standard of living, everything between the United States and Britain today, obviously, in many ways, physically speaking, we are much greater and stronger. They were greater because there was a time when they were truly a multitude of nations and the sun never set. All right, now chapter 49. This is a very remarkable chapter. Describing here, he said, we already learned that they would be a multitude of nations, right? Here in chapter 49, verse 1, and Jacob called his sons and said, gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. That's the key right there, in the last days. The days before the Messiah comes, the day before the kingdom is set up. He goes, talks about everyone. If you read about these nations, about these tribes, they obviously are not bordering one another as one nation anymore. They are separate nations at the time of the end, except for a couple of them would be within other nations. But predominantly, it's interesting about Judah, verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. Quite a prophecy there about him and his character and what he would be like. Also, you find verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough, a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him and hated him, but his bow remains in strength. And the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. And from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. And by the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you, with blessings of heaven above, with blessings of the deep that lies beneath, and blessings of the breasts and of the womb. The blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors, as he goes on, up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. Well, we, a lot of times when we read that, think of us, the United States. But we need to realize it's to Joseph. That means Ephraim and Manasseh, right? Now you look around at some of the major nations that come under that commonwealth today and still are a part of it. Is Canada a nation that would fit some of this description? How about Australia, New Zealand, we just saw? I'd love to go to New Zealand. My wife and I both would love to go there. When we had our 40th anniversary, went to Canada, to the Canadian Rockies. And that was, I mean, it is breathtaking. And we have spent the feast in Canada back in, when was that, 02, wasn't it? Yeah, yes, up in Quebec. And it was amazing to, you know, just to see. We didn't leave the United States, you might say. It's so prosperous. Everything is so well there. And our son has gone to the feast years ago in Australia, of course, on the Gold Coast in that area, Sydney to Melbourne and up north to Brisbane, I believe it is, and Auckland, New Zealand, and South Africa, where we've been. South Africa is, you think you're in the United States in many places when you go there. It is an incredible country. It is, I mean, they've got in the Western Cape mountains that remind you of the Rockies, beautiful wine vineyards out there. You think you're in California in some places out there. It's just incredible. And talk about the gold. When you drive around the belt route, I'll call it, around Johannesburg, And you, they have their, it's not trash mountains up there. It's not Mount Trashmore's, but they, well, I guess it is, but it's not trash. It is all of the stuff left over from digging the gold out from under Johannesburg. You just have to see it to believe. I mean, it just goes on and on. This is high. These higher than the Mount Trashmore's here. And it just keeps going. And you hope that it doesn't cave in. But the gold is there. And the British were fighting with in the Boer War with the Dutch. And they won to get the gold from Johannesburg. And, of course, you find a lot of the Dutch today, descendants of the Dutch that lived there, that had settled there, they were the Afrikaners today. They don't want to be called Dutch or anything like that, but they are the descendants of those people, and they are Afrikaners. They speak their own language, Afrikaans, and they have multiple languages in South Africa. But anyhow, the point is, very prosperous. Despite all of its racial problems, apartheid and all of that, it is a very wealthy country. It really is. And you see it, all you got to do is just drive around if you're there, and go into the supermarkets, go anywhere. Go down the main streets of Durban, South Africa. I mean, you think you're in New York City. I couldn't believe that city was as big as it was. And skyscrapers and everything going up. Incredible. Anyhow, let me get back here to go along. But the point is, God has fulfilled what he said, what he would do here. He really has in the end times. And, of course, that doesn't mean it's going to stay that way up until the coming of Christ. We know it's not. Let me get back here and move forward. In Deuteronomy 33, we see, it's interesting about Moses and how he is referred to. In Deuteronomy 33, which is a parallel prophecy of the time of the end of the tribes, just like Genesis 49 was. In chapter 30, if I get to it, keep turning pages here, I'm trying to get up to 33. There it is, 33. And in verse 1, now this is the blessing with which Moses, the man of God, blessed the children of Israel before his death. Now that statement there, Moses, the man of God, that means he is a prophet. And you will find that spoken of Samuel, for example, that when that term is used, a man of God, it means that he is a prophet. And Moses was indeed a prophet. This is a prophecy that is being given here in the 33rd chapter of Deuteronomy. You'll find that, I said, in 1 Samuel 2, verse 27, 1 Samuel 9, verse 6, always talking about the man of God. And Samuel was a prophet, and he was also referred to as the man of God. verse 13, we see, now we get to, of course, Israel, and particularly Joseph. And of Joseph he said, blessed of the Lord is his land, with the precious things of heaven, and with the dew and the deep of lying beneath, with the precious fruits of the sun, with the precious produce of the mouths, with the best things of the ancient mountains, with the precious things of the everlasting hills. Well, this is paralleling Genesis 49. With the precious things of the earth and its fullness, and the favor of him who dwelt in the bush. That's right. The one who would become Jesus Christ. Let the blessing come on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. Now, that doesn't say that at all about any of the others, does it? Including Judah. Verse 17, his glory is like a firstborn bull and his horns like the horns of the wild ox. Together with them, he shall push the peoples to the ends of the earth. Not the ends of the land of Canaan, but to the ends of the earth. And they are the 10,000s of Ephraim and the thousands of Manasseh. Well, again, has that been fulfilled? Did you see that anywhere in the Old Testament? No, never did happen in the Old Testament. It's a remarkable thing because it was for the time of the end. A couple more scriptures going along here, and we're going to go into bring Judah into it and the Davidic covenant in a moment. Let's go to 1 Chronicles 5. I'm taking them in order here. I always like to do it that way. I don't know, it just makes more sense to me. And 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 1 and 2. get there in just a moment. Yes, 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 1 and 2. Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, and he was indeed the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph. That's back in, Genesis 35, I believe. The son of Israel, so that the genealogy is not listed according to the birthright. In other words, it's out of order. Yet Judah prevailed over his brothers, and from him came a ruler. Now, notice that the word came is in italics. First Chronicles was written 400 years before Christ came, right? Yet Judah prevailed over his brothers, and from him shall come, it should be, a ruler, meaning Christ, although the birthright was Joseph's. Was means past tense. When did it end? Again, translators, of course, using the wrong word, the birthright is Joseph's. It hasn't ever ended. But that verse does say something quite clearly when you look at it from what Ezra most likely was the one who wrote that, finishing the last book of the Bible. Yet Judah prevailed over his brothers, and from him shall come a ruler. Well, that was he wrote this 400 years before Christ made his first appearance. And although the birthright, and it should be, is Joseph's, it's not was, there's no place where it ever ended, and or where God said that it had ended. Now let's go to Psalm 89. Here we get into the Davidic covenant. And this is so incredible when you look at God decided everywhere along the way, he adds something to the plan, to the promises given originally to Abraham. There's continual addition as the nation grows in numbers. And it's God who makes the decisions, isn't it? And so, like I say, how was it that Judah prevailed? Did he prevail over his brethren because he was more righteous? No, I have never seen that anywhere. But it was proclivities that he saw there, and that he wanted his son to come through the house of Judah. And chapter 89 here of Psalms, so let's take a look at Psalm 89, verse 3 and 4. I have made a covenant with my chosen. I have sworn to my servant David, your seed I will establish forever and build up your throne to all generations. Okay, but there's more to the story. Drop down to verse 34. Verse 34. My covenant I will not break, nor alter the word that has gone out from my lips. Once I have sworn to my holy, by my holiness, I will not lie to David. God cannot lie. And we see that in the New Testament, two scriptures, Titus 1, verse 2, Hebrews 6:18. It is impossible for God to lie. I cannot lie to David. His seed shall endure, and his throne as the sun before me, and it shall be established forever like the moon, even like the faithful witness in the sky. And so God has made a promise that in no way, there's no wiggly room here, is there, to get out of this when you make a statement like that. In Jeremiah 33, which will be about 300 years later, maybe 350, Jeremiah is inspired to write about this at the fall of Jerusalem. At the time, in 586, when all that's going to be left is the king's daughters. So here in Jeremiah 33 and in verse 17, for thus says the Lord, David shall never lack a man to sit on the throne of the house of Israel. There'll never be a lack of that being possible. Nor shall the priests, the Levites, lack a man to all offer burn offerings before me, to kindle grain offerings and to sacrifice continually. Some have brought that up and said, well, okay, why don't we have continual offerings? Well, because there's not a temple. But what the scripture says, there will never lack a man. Look, the Jewish people know who the Levites are in the house of Cohen. That if they ever get around to doing that, and they will, whether they build a temple or not, I don't know yet, may and may not. But we know there's going to be an altar, and there are going to be evening and morning sacrifices, and those of the house of Cohen, of the Levites, will be doing it. And they know who they are. It's not any mystery to them. So they don't lack that. The only thing they lack is an altar and a temple. Coming back here, verse 19, and the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, saying, thus says the Lord, if you can break my covenant with the day and my covenant with the night, so there will not be day and night in their season. In other words, if you can stop the rotation of the earth, then my covenant may also be broken with David, my servant, so that he shall not have a son to reign on his throne, and with the Levites, the priests, my ministers. In other words, it will always be there, they will be there, and there will always be a descendant of the house of David. House of David, of course, where did that come from? That was Judah after Solomon's death. The story, Rehoboam decided to get real tough, and so Jeroboam separated. They went north, kingdom of Israel, northern kingdom of Israel, and then you had the southern kingdom of Israel. It's interesting when you look to see, time has gone by. This is prophesied at the time when Judah is going into captivity, when Jeremiah gives this. There is no room for a 2,500-year gap with this kind of language in the Davidic covenant. Do you ever think about that? Because you know what is the common teaching? Well, there's a gap. It will not resume until Christ returns. And then the dynasty of David will continue. No, it won't. David will be a spirit being. He will not die and have his sons continued as a dynasty through the millennium. It will be Jesus Christ and David over the house of Israel. Now, some will cite Hosea chapter 3 and verse 4 and 5, in which they try to say that there would not be a king over the house of Israel, which is not a problem. I take a look at that real quickly. Hosea chapter 3 and verse 4 and 5. For the children of Israel shall abide many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or teraphim. And afterwards the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. And they shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. Now, there isn't any problem there, because in verse 4, who is Israel? Jacob said, my name be put on your sons, Joseph. And of course, then you have verse 5 is millennial, when Christ returns and David is resurrected and now is a spirit being. And yes, they will turn to David, and all the other tribes will as well. The thing one should keep in mind is Israel will be without a king, but the Davidic covenant comes through the line of Judah, not through the house of Israel. There is a difference. Now, there is something I wanted to mention, because how would all these things happen that we would have this gap of time? One other one before I go there. 2 Chronicles 13. Take a look at 2 Chronicles 13 and verse 5 on the Davidic covenant. Chapter 13 and in verse 5. Should you not know that the Lord God of Israel gave the dominion over Israel to David forever, to him and his sons, by a covenant of salt? By a covenant of salt. Now, a covenant of salt means the promise was permanent and it cannot be taken back or be broken in any way. So I wanted to cover all those scriptures, and we'll move here forward, because obviously there's been quite a gap of time has gone by, and it's interesting. Let's go back here to Leviticus 26 to explain about this time gap. And this seems to fool a lot of people. In Leviticus 26, you have the promises of the blessings and the cursings and so forth. It's parallel to that as in Deuteronomy 28, but I want to only look at a couple scriptures here in Leviticus 26 and notice what it is saying. In Leviticus 26, verse 18, it says, "And after all this, if you do not obey me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins." Now, it's interesting because that "I will punish you seven times more for your sins" is repeated in verse 21, 24, and 28. Now, the word seven, which is a common word you can find throughout the usage in the Old Testament, has several meanings. The Hebrew word is Sheva, S-H-E-V-A. It's usually used as an adjective. For example, he had seven cows. That is, it modifies a noun, or 7 days. But in these verses, these four verses, it stands alone as an adverb and modifies the verb to punish, to punish. In this case, when it does that, it can mean an increase in intensity or duration or repetition of an action over a period of time, or it can mean both. Let's look at some examples here real quickly. An example of intensity would be in Daniel 3, verse 19. Let me just tell you what it was. The fiery furnace, what did Nebuchadnezzar say? Heated up seven times more. That's intensity, isn't it? Another example, this one of repetition, would be in Psalm 119. Let me turn to, because you may not be familiar with this one, Psalm 119. And verse 164. This would be an example of the word seven being used as repetition. Seven times a day I praise you because of your righteous judgments. Repeating it seven times a day. Another one of repetition would be Proverbs chapter 24. And what's the verse here? Verse 16, Proverbs 24 and verse 16. Let me tell you what that says. The righteous may fall seven times, but they will get up seven times. They don't give up, right? Repetition of falling seven times in order. Now, an example of it being used for corrective punishment would be that of Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel 4, verse 32. You're going to be what? Seven times. And that had to do with punishment. And that's what we're talking about. That's what God is talking about in Leviticus 26. Seven times, and repeats it there. It's four times, which would be punishment that would come to them. So it is used in three different ways, but it can be used certainly when it comes to corrective punishment seven times. Now, this chapter is a prophecy. That is Leviticus chapter 26, and it's and in prophecy, a day is as a year. We know that Numbers 14:34 and Ezekiel 4:6 says that a day is as a year in prophecy. Now, if it's looking at it as seven times when it comes as corrective punishment, well, then seven times a prophetic year, which is 360 days, is 2,520. Now, a couple things come out here that just hard to just say it's time, you know, just coincidence. We know that the northern nation of Israel was overrun by the Assyrians in 720 BC to 721. Now, you can just do it there if you had a pencil and paper, just take a 2520 and subtract 720 and then add one because you crossed BC to AD, okay? What do you come up with? 1800, don't you? Anything significant happen around 1800? Yeah. You look at British history and begin to see what happened. They became a great empire. 1803, what happened? Louisiana Purchase. By the way, it's interesting because Jefferson only wanted to buy New Orleans as a port for trade because the Spaniards had it. Then they made a deal with the French, and that was a secret and not made open. But it finally leaked out, and Jefferson and the colonials, of course, discovered it. So eventually he sent Monroe to Paris to make a deal with Napoleon's representatives. And Napoleon, because he felt in the war that he was in with the British, by the way, at the time, that there was no way that he could hang on to it, so it was of no more value. So rather than just New Orleans, he sold the whole what's called the Louisiana Purchase, Rocky Mountains, all the way up into Alberta, Canada, Saskatchewan. And that whole area, which doubled the size of the fledgling United States, I guess, were we called the United States at that time? I guess maybe we were, but anyhow, you'd have to go count on a map how many states that eventually turned out to be. That really turned everything around for the United States, or for this country, and it turned everything around for the British, who won. Who defeated the fifth head of the resurrection of the ancient Roman Empire, Napoleon? Wellington. Waterloo. And the British then became the dominant power and empire throughout the 19th century. And who was it that allowed for the beginning of a Jewish state in what was called Palestine? Did the Germans? The Russians? The British? The Balfour Declaration. He was originally, Balfour was a prime minister of Britain at around the turn of the century. Then he was, what was his title by 1917, and he was a minority, by the way. Most of the British didn't want to do that, and they wanted to renege on it through the 20s and 30s. But after what happened in World War II, there was no reneging anymore. It had to be carried out. Getting back here. Southern Kingdom of Judah went through about from 604, 605 down to 586, several invasions. The final one in destruction, burning of the temple, was 586. But if you go back to the first one in which Daniel was taken captive, 604, right in that period of time, well, subtract 604 from 2520 and add 1. And what do you get? 1917. What happened in 1917? That would impact the Jewish people? The Balfour Declaration. Is that just a coincidence? No, not at all. Yet that word seven there, it can be used and is used in three different ways in the Old Testament. And especially when it comes to corrective punishment. That was a long time. And the northern, all of these nations, Jesus Christ sent his people to the diaspora. And to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And they wandered, and eventually most of them wandered their way into northwestern Europe. And I don't want to take the time to get into all of that today, how they got there, but I might present that again sometime. But I do want to go here to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6. Now, by the time Jesus Christ came to the earth, the northern nation of Israel had been dispersed. Even the Assyrian kingdom was no longer existed. The Babylonian kingdom no longer existed. Persians were gone. Greeks were gone. It was the Romans in charge. Over 700 years, close to 750 years have gone by when we get to the ministry of Jesus Christ. This nation, we're what, 250 years, somewhere close to that, maybe a little longer. If you go back to the original colony, 1607, Jamestown, what is that? We're looking at 400 years and so on. 750 years approximately has gone by. Did those people just disappear off the earth? It was quite a population, by the way, of the northern kingdom of Israel. But here in Matthew 6, he tells his disciples, Matthew 10, I'm sorry, he tells his disciples what he wants them to do. Chapter 10 and in verse 6. But go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Judah. No, the house of Israel. Go to the house of Israel. In verse 23, when they persecute you in this city, flee to another. For assuredly I say to you, you will not have gone through the cities of Judah before the Son of Man comes. Israel, right? The cities of Judah, though, well, the reason I put that in there is because they did go through the cities of Judah. What cities of Judah did they not go through? They were in Alexandria, Egypt. They were in Babylon. Peter was there. They even had went to Rome. They went to, those aren't the cities, that they had synagogues, but they're not the cities of the Jews. They went to the first city of the Jews, primarily that was Jerusalem. And from there they went out. They went to Samaria. They went all throughout Judea and Galilee to all of the cities of those who had come back from the captivity. Where else did they go? I have another book here I brought along. This is a really an interesting read. Maybe some of you have seen it and bought it. The Search for the 12 Apostles by William Stuart McBurney. And it's updated here and everything. You can get it out of Amazon.com and so on. But it covers all of the Latin and the Greek Orthodox histories of where the apostles went. Some legendary, some they can pretty well confirm. And they certainly, one thing they do know, that several of them were in the British Isles. Andrew, who died in St. Albans, Peter, who returned from there, Paul, they believe, was up. What were they doing up there anyhow? Why were they going into northwestern Europe? Why did Paul say in Romans, was it 15, verse 28, that I want to come by you, Rome, on my way to Spain? Well, what's he going to Spain for? Because that is where you catch your ship to go to Hibernia, Ireland, and to the British Isles, and through the Iberian Peninsula, or Spain. They were there. One of the great evidences of where to start looking and tracking is, where did the apostles go? They were to go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Paul was later called to do what? To go to the Gentiles. But if you read his commission, he had a three-part commission. You go here to Jerusalem, to Judah, to Israel, and to the Gentiles, and to the house of Israel. He had a three-part commission. He always went to the synagogue when he came into any city, didn't he? That's where he started. And from there, once he was kicked out, and you know the rest of the story, he'd go to those who would believe and accept him. Well, anyhow, it's a fascinating thing to see when we look at this. Where were they and where did they go? And there's much, I might go back and go through that series I've done before with the Danites, with the various descendants and the various places that they went through the wildernesses to wind up where they were. You know, people can migrate quite a distance, especially if God is guiding and leading them and they don't even know it. Over 700 years of time, and they truly have. Well, all of the scriptures I've given so far together show us how that God fulfills his word. It is marvelous how he works and fulfills every word of prophecy over millenniums of time. And even when these dates came, nothing happened right at the time of the end, when the date ended. But look, within a couple years after that date, and a lot of things did begin to happen. Hopefully, this will help us to understand who God is talking about when he speaks of Israel in the end time. We can know in prophecy who is Israel and who is Judah in the time of the end.